This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
In both the intro episode to this podcast and episode two, we focused on the state of Wyoming. It's kind of my template for a small population red state that liberals could maybe flip. We're going to focus on Wyoming again today a little bit with our guest. It was 21 years ago this October that University of Wyoming student Matthew Shepard was beaten, tortured, and left tied to a fence. He died a few days later, and his murder brought national attention to hate crime legislation, LGBT rights and protections, and along with a subsequent murder trial, inspired a number of works, including documentaries and the stage play The Laramie Project. Matthew's mother, Judy, went on to start the Matthew Shepard Foundation in Casper, Wyoming. So today we are joined by the executive director of that organization, the Matthew Shepard Foundation, Jason Marsden. Jason, welcome to Clusterfucked.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
How did you get involved with the foundation, and maybe tell us a little bit about the mission of the foundation?
Sure. I'll start with the second first. The foundation's mission is to replace hate with understanding, compassion, and acceptance, which is a, you know, very ambitious goal for an organization of eight type A personalities working out of a little office in Denver, Colorado. but it's our belief that it is accomplishable if individual people in large numbers decide that they want to live in a world free of hate. It could happen free of charge. It would make the world a much better place. And it would fulfill the fondest hope of Judy and Dennis Shepard, which is being in a position to close the organization down because it's no longer needed.
Because the work is done.
As it stands, it is very much needed, and always has been over the 20 years since its formation. It grew out of spontaneous generosity from people. When Matt was in the hospital and after he died, the Shepherds received about 25,000 pieces of mail, within which many people enclosed cash or checks. And the money wasn't asked for, and they weren't sure what they were supposed to do with it, but there was enough that they felt that they could at least lay a cornerstone for an organization that would give them some resources to continue being visible advocates for civil rights for LGBTQ people and also for all marginalized populations. I was a friend of Matt's and a reporter at the statewide newspaper when all this happened. So I was very close to the story, and I decided to come out in a column on the opinion page. And Mrs. Shepard came down to the newsroom to thank me for writing what I did about Matt, and for standing up and being visible for the community, which under the circumstances they were dealing with, I couldn't believe the kindness of her to come and speak to a little 26-year-old reporter. And so I stayed in touch and I volunteered. I was one of the people who went to the basement of the law firm downtown where they set up tables and put out Rubbermaid containers, and we opened and sorted those 25,000 pieces of mail, which were letters from LGBTQ people, were letters from parents of members of the community, some who had lost loved ones to hate crimes already in their lives, and drawings by children, letters from fourth grade classrooms, letter from Coretta Scott King, and every kind of person was represented in that avalanche of goodwill.
Certainly the opposite of, the hate that fueled the crime in the first place.
Yeah, it's a spontaneous outpouring of love and compassion. And it was like coins in the wishing well, as I thought of it at the time. And people were sort of wishing that maybe their $20 bill might make a difference. And it did. It created this organization.
So at the time, as you said, you were a reporter. And how soon after his murder did you write that column you mentioned where you came out?
Well, he was in intensive care for like 4 or 5 days before he died in the early morning hours of October 12th, which was a Monday morning. So I came into the newsroom that morning and decided I was going to write that column, and it ran in the paper the next day.
A very bold move, needless to say. And how was it received?
Very warmly. People sent flowers. I got letters and cards, phone calls. The very conservative Speaker of the Wyoming House of Representatives called me and he and I never agreed much on the time of day, I think, but he was very gracious and thanked me for being courageous. And I got a couple pieces of hate mail. I keep them in a desk drawer here at the foundation still, and I want to have a chuckle at what people were like in Wyoming 20 years ago, but the vast majority of them were just lovely about it.
On that note, I would imagine that, in Wyoming, his murder activated the LGBT movement. I mean, what was the atmosphere at that time? I mean, obviously, you wrote the column to come out, so you weren't out. Was there much going on in that community at the time?
Yeah, well, I was in and out, and coming out is a thing that you do every day, every time you meet a new person. But I was out to close friends, out to my mom, out to my sister, but not out to, the people who worked in advertising or circulation at the paper, or the people in the sports department, or some of the reporters I didn't work closely with. And, not out to my grandparents or my aunts and uncles. And so it was kind of, I was sort of halfway out. The community, I think, was similarly disposed. There certainly was a gay community. We knew each other. We knew who each other were. There's a social life, although there isn't really wasn't at that time really a highly organized community, like in terms of a nonprofit or a resource center or even a gay bar. There still isn't one. But informally, through, the networks you have in small towns, we were, I think, visible. And people in the broader community certainly stood with us. There were candlelight vigils all over the state with hundreds of people at them. The vast majority of those people were heterosexual, presumably. But it felt like the community was standing in solidarity with us at that time.
Did a lot of other people take a similar action to you then at that time? I mean, obviously not everyone has a newspaper column to do so, but were other people also sort of inspired out of the tragedy to enough of this, let's go?
There were a few people I talked to around that time who similarly came out to more distant family or in their workplace. It wasn't a groundswell or anything. There's hardly enough people in Wyoming to get the wave going at a football game, but it definitely moved a lot of people. And our work over the years, I've encountered countless LGBT people my age who also came out around that time because of how they felt about Matt's murder and their feeling that they should be responsible for some change.
Would you say, though, that it activated a LGBT community in Wyoming, or was it still at the time sort of scattered as you described it earlier?
I guess I'd describe it as being at the beginning point of where it got to now. There was already a statewide organization, but it had very kind of limited reach, mostly in the Cheyenne and Laramie area. And they started around that time to grow their board of directors and grow their annual Pride event and expand what they were offering in terms of HIV prevention events and so on. But it was a gradual transformation. Their newsletter to this day has a little corner in it with called Matt's Corner, every issue that comes out with a image of a lit candle in it and the words "never again." So, people are still very cognizant of that tragedy and how it activated Wyoming's LGBT community to a greater degree than it had been.
Did you, when you mentioned earlier that you when you personally came out and, even close relatives did not know, was there any backlash personally?
Not at that time. I have some relatives who are not LGBTQ accepting, and that's been a personal challenge, but that came about years later. But at this point, 1998, everyone really was just concerned about my well-being and the community's well-being, and really just feeling the tragedy for what it was.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier you actually knew Matt, like how well?
Oh, reasonably well. We weren't best friends or anything, but he was one of the few people in the gay community at that time whom I knew to be engaged in civic life and what's going on in the news, and opinionated about politics, and had a strong interest in foreign affairs, and particularly in human rights and women's rights, and was very focused on having a future in either the diplomatic service or working for an international relief nonprofit, something like that. So when I would run into him at the silly little parties that made up gay social life in Wyoming in the late 1990s, we would talk about President Clinton's impeachment or things that were going on in the world. And I don't think he really had anyone else to talk to about that. And I didn't really. So that we kind of fulfilled a particular role for one another.
So he was almost ahead of his time in a way, like being in Wyoming. And I mean, I don't mean that, you know, following Clinton's impeachment has put you ahead of your time, but I just mean very, very politically active and thinking about the greater world beyond Wyoming.
Yeah, he clearly had a future outside the four corners of the state. I felt. My now husband was closer to Matt. They were classmates in school. They acted in a performance of Camelot together in like 10th grade, I think. So, and he and I were just beginning to date at that time. So he experienced this loss through a similar lens. And one of the, you know, maybe the fourth or fifth quote unquote date we went on was to go to Matt's funeral in Casper.
And he, if I'm not mistaken, went on to become mayor of Casper, Wyoming, correct?
Yes, he did. He was the first openly gay elected official in state history. Not the first gay one, but the first one who was out.
And what year was that he won election?
He was elected to the city council in 2002, and he served as mayor in 2005.
Was he out at the time of Matthew's murder, or same scenario as you?
The same scenario. He was out to family and his friends, but he wasn't a public figure in any way, so there's really no need for him to be publicly out in any way. He was just a college student.
But within 4 years, he's elected as mayor of Casper and is at that time open and out, correct?
Yeah, they did a piece that, 5 years later in Time magazine in 2003, and a reporter kept, you know, asking around town how has life changed for LGBT people, and several people were like, well, there's a gay city councilman here now. So the reporter, the late John Cloud, who was really a great journalist and much missed, tracked a guy down and interviewed him, and he actually called Judy Shepard and asked her for some advice about how to navigate the, you know, coming out publicly. Because during the campaign, we didn't, you know, it didn't say gay on his yard signs or anything.
Right.
And he campaigned largely on infrastructure issues in West Casper, which is the ward that he represented. And no one asked us about it. And, you know, the address for his campaign was my house. And all the people we knew that we'd been together for 4 years at that point. But, nobody thought to ask his sexual orientation. So he had to decide, you know, am I going to come out about this publicly in the news media? And decided, of course, why wouldn't I? And so he came out to the Casper Star Tribune and gave them an opportunity to break the news before he did the Time magazine interview. But that was quite a journey.
Yeah, I can imagine. And this was after he was elected?
Yeah, so Casper has a mayor-manager system. So he was elected in 2002 to one of 9 seats on the city council. And the piece about Where's Wyoming 5 years after Matthew Shepard ran in like late summer of 2003. So he'd been in office for like 6 months or so. And again, you know, we go to art museum gala or whatever and sit together. And I think everybody in town that cared or would want to know already knew he was gay, but there was no official like dropping of the balloons or cutting of the ribbon. So that came about through media coverage. And then he went back to being a public servant and working on infrastructure issues and public transit and parks and all the things that city councils take care of.
Did he run for re-election?
He did. He was re-elected in 2006 and served another 2.5 years before we moved down to Denver in 2009 because I was offered this position at that time.
So obviously his sexuality did not impact his electability at all?
No. And as he once said, I can't remember, it might have been in an interview, but he said, there's no particularly gay way to fill a pothole. And people just didn't really, it didn't make that much difference, you know? And there's this, Wyoming has this sort of strange way of dealing with things. They don't really embrace or call out for diversity necessarily, but they're not excluding members of our community from participating in civic life either. And of course, opinions vary between the people who are super religious and the ones who are really quite secular. And it's just one of those things that people seem to be okay with at a certain distance anyway.
That's where I was going to go. I was going to say, you know, obviously homophobia can be an issue anywhere one lives, but obviously red states tend to be associated with it more, or at least people assume the bigots are there in, you know, bigger numbers. Do you think homophobia is still the issue it once was in a place like Wyoming?
Well, you know, what I've learned in this work is that everything is happening always. You know, the people who are homophobic are angrier now than they've been in a long time because the community has made a great deal of progress, which politically there are people out there, I'd count it being about 30% of the population, who are just dead set opposed to homosexuality and to varying degrees will try to marginalize it from their lives or from their communities. So that, as part of the polarization of this country, has, I think, gotten more intense. Whereas people who are supportive of LGBT rights are kind of on the upswing and experiencing, you know, the fruits of legislative and judicial processes that brought us into the light of day as members of a minority community. And then there's the vast majority of people who are wondering, you know, chicken or beef for dinner, who just really engaged in this debate, don't see its relevance to their own lives. Perhaps they do when their kid comes out or the neighbor kid comes out or their favorite TV star comes out. But there's a broad, I think, plurality of Americans who really are not particularly opinionated on the subject. And I think that population has grown and will probably continue to grow.
Well, it's probably good to have them in that place, at least where they're not actively opposing rather than, you know, you'd rather have that, in other words, than, you know, actively in opposition.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it's kind of been amazing, though, to see the numbers move. If you look at polling, it was only, you know, during the Bush election, you know, 2004 or whatever, where there were a lot of amendments against marriage equality on various state ballots, and that brought out a lot of the voters. And if you looked at, you know, where people were, the population was opposed. And now, latest Gallup poll that I saw, I think it's up to 68% of Americans are in favor of, you know, marriage of equality. So, I mean, for the numbers to move relatively quickly like that, it's been a great breakthrough, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to some extent, it's been because of personal familiarity. What we've seen consistently in social research and polling is that personally knowing a member of our community is the number one, far and away, motivator for someone to become supportive of LGBTQ rights. So it's the people who have come out of the closet over the years, I think, drove that process. And then I think, God bless them. I'm sure they're only trying to do what they believe in. But the people who opposed our community's equality made some pretty dire predictions about what was going to happen if we were, you know, treated decently. It was going to be the end of civilization and the institution of marriage and mass hysteria. And lo and behold, none of those things happened. At some point, if you're predicting the end of the world damn well better end, or people are going to think you're full of crap.
It isn't that one side or the other has a complete monopoly on hysterical predictions. But in this case, to me, never has there been an issue that literally doesn't affect so many people that yet so many people are worked up about it. But I think that was part of the success of the movement, was to just make the case patiently, hey, we should be able to marry who we love. It's not affecting your life. We're taxpayers. We're I always thought here in Toronto, where I am, we've always had a massive gay pride event. And I always thought one of the more powerful moments of the parade, which often draws up to 1 million people, were gay people marching in, whatever it is that they do, whether they're police officers or mail carriers or firefighters. I mean, all the costumes and all that, that's all great theater. But to say, hey, look, this is who we are. We're among you. We just do our jobs and live our lives. And I always thought that was one of the more powerful statements and probably helped the cause a lot. But as you said, the biggest thing is just knowing someone and realizing, when we see, Vice President Cheney all those years ago, realize his daughter was gay. And so it's hard for him to continue to oppose, although he was on the party that did. But, you know what I mean. Now, those that, as you mentioned, I would think in places like Wyoming, it's still a little tougher to be in that community. Those who choose to stay in a state like Wyoming, Why do you think that is? Is there enough going on in the community that might attract other like-minded people to come there? Is the fight more important there in some ways because of some of these rigid viewpoints? Why do you think they stay?
Well, I think the number one reason anyone stays anywhere is that's where all their stuff is,
Yeah.
Not to be glib. Like, inertia is a powerful factor surrounding where people choose to live. So, to want to leave, you're going to either want to feel like you're not welcome, or feel like you could be earning more money or have better opportunities elsewhere. Or maybe you're single and you'd like to find your life partner and you're not finding that person where you are because there aren't enough potential mates around. So, it's home, it's hearth, it's romantic affection. It's the ability to make a living. Those are the basic reasons anybody either moves somewhere or decides to stay where they are. And for the LGBTQ community and some other minority communities, there's an overlay on that of am I welcome here for real? Like, do I have opportunity? Do I face any particular danger or setback by remaining here? Do I have realistic hope that things are generally getting better and will continue to get better here? Or are they going backwards? And so the people in the LGBTQ community in Wyoming who've chosen to stay there are able to answer those questions yes, for the most part. And I think the people who were not able to answer those questions yes, left or will ultimately leave.
The people who have stayed, though, it does sound like, from what you're saying, that things have gotten better and staying isn't the most horrible decision it might have been decades ago.
Oh, yeah. I know them. They're happy. several couples that, have been together forever, like Guy and I have, are now married like we are. They have good jobs. I'm thinking of a couple teachers, administrator up at the two-year college, a couple of people who work in government roles who are active with specific charities up there. Those folks are pillars of the community, not just the LGBTQ community in Casper, or Cheyenne or Laramie for that matter, but their whole community. And a lot of them love it there. They love the outdoors. They love being away from the big city rat race. And, so they're outnumbered politically. That's not the most important consideration for a lot of people.
No, but I'm personally glad they're there because, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, that's probably one of the reasons that even in a place like Wyoming, the numbers are moving in the right direction in terms of acceptance and, supporting marriage equality and all the rest, because they are actually knowing people in the community. Now, on this podcast, we talk a lot about, ways in which red states might become more liberal. And obviously, the one way that I have sort of set up as one of the premises of this podcast is liberals actually literally moving to red states. Might address that in a second. But the other way, of course, is changing minds of the people that are already there. We've seen, obviously, Democrats win elections in some of these smaller red states. Now, having lived in Wyoming at least for a time as an adult, what typical Democratic issues do you think play well there and would have a chance at motivating voters to elect Democrats or go across the aisle and vote for a Democrat for a change?
Yeah, there's a few. Wyoming people especially treasure their public lands, the majority of which are federally held. They're in national forests, national parks, obviously, like Yellowstone and Grand Teton are well known all around the world, but also upland dry prairie where sage grouse mate and where all kinds of critters make their homes. Wyoming has a vigorous hunting and fishing culture. Hunters and anglers are a potent political force, and there have been many times over recent decades when Republican lawmakers or administrations make moves to privatize some of those public lands, especially Bureau of Land Management land. And those are times when typically Republican voting Wyoming sportsmen and sportswomen can become very anxious about loss of access to those lands and consider voting for Democrats. At times of economic downturn, when the state has had to cut to the bone and has made major cuts to education, there have been Democrats elected governor or to the legislature on a platform of preserving public education and improving Wyoming's tax structure so it's not so dependent on the boom and bust cycle of minerals and energy commodities. And also personal freedom. There have been successful Democratic candidates in Wyoming who stress the right to be yourself, whether that's women's reproductive freedom or LGBT rights or racial and religious inclusivity. Those messages play well in a state that where people really value their privacy.
Yeah, I would think that there could be common ground found between some Democrats and the libertarians that you were sort of talking about, who talk about personal freedom. I mean, a true libertarian should completely be supportive of LGBT rights and, I think, and even be pro-choice with, none of the government's business kind of mentality.
Yeah. So, and there have been, compared to other states, libertarianism is pretty tiny everywhere by the numbers. But compared to other states, Wyoming has been more receptive to libertarian candidates' messages over the years. And in fact, Wyoming was, along with New Hampshire and a couple other states, was being considered for a libertarian version of hey, why don't we all move there and we can take the place over, which I think was a little tongue-in-cheek. And eventually, I think they settled on New Hampshire. But there's definitely some resonance to those messages of keeping the government out of your private life.
Well, I'm a little tongue-in-cheek too on this podcast when I say the new liberal movement must be literal. I know that what you spoke of earlier is certainly rings true, that obviously people move where they move, if they move, for opportunities, and in some of these smaller places there may not be as much. I think of clustering also as figuratively too, where I find a lot of liberals are sort of just talking to people who already agree with them. And there, certainly after Trump was elected, there was this understandable reaction. I don't even want to talk to a Trump voter. You know, I'm angry, and I know plenty of people who, you know, defriended anyone in their social media feeds who supported Trump or the Republicans or anything. And it's an understandable reaction, but the reality is that we do ultimately want to win more elections and persuade people and see more people come on board on our side of the aisle. So I feel like, you know, figuratively, we shouldn't be clustering either. And, it's great to hear of these people, like you said, that are staying in Wyoming and just, you know, living by example and making the case, where there can be common ground found. It sounds like that's what's going on, at least.
I think so. I mean, what I think has been helpful in mainstreaming LGBTQ people in Wyoming is disconnecting it from partisan orientation. For people increasingly to understand that there are gay conservatives and there are lesbian Republicans, and that it's not required to be a dyed-in-the-wool liberal to be a member of our community. I think as the understanding of that has spread, that it's been easier for people to be inclusive of our community as a result of not feeling so politically threatened by our beliefs. And I think it's equally true that conservative people cluster. They just do it in different places in different ways. They cluster around religious institutions or recreational activities or in many cases, living in exurban or rural environments. And there's plenty of them that don't want to give the time of day to a liberal, as there are liberals who don't want to talk to the people with the red baseball caps. So
I totally agree with you, obviously. But my thing is I just want to see, Democrats and liberals win more elections. So, to me, it's all about instead of finding common ground, which is a phrase we hear a lot, and I think I even used it a few minutes ago, to me, it's more about I would rather see, liberals persuade. And the way you do that is not yelling at people or calling them bigots or whatever, even if you may feel they are. The way you do that is to make your case and not be afraid to do so. So, it's encouraging to me when I see liberals doing that. Anyway, we are running out of time here, but before I let you go, I mentioned off the top, it's coming up on the anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death. Do you do special events at the foundation around that anniversary?
I would describe it as an exhausting whirlwind of a little bit of everything. We have speaking engagements all over the country in the next 3 months. We have law enforcement and prosecutor trainings, community hate crime panel discussions, fundraising events, special performances of the Laramie Project in various parts of the country. As Mao said, give me 3 men and I'll take the village. I will talk to anyone who genuinely wants a better understanding of what happened to Matt and what it means and what they can do. And as packed as my calendar is, Judy and Dennis Shepherd's is vastly more so. Anyone listening to this anywhere on the continent, if you're in an airport, look around for a familiar face. Judy Shepherd might be standing in line behind you to board a flight to go talk to high school students and middle school students. We're getting invites from more often, which is very affirming and positive. We'll be very busy.
It's amazing that out of such a tragedy, that so much energy and positive force can come out of it, especially for her, for having lost a child. Can't imagine a bigger tragedy, and in the way that it happened. But it sounds like you guys are doing great stuff. What are any numbers on how often the Laramie Project has been performed in total?
Oh my God, a few thousand performances minimum. There's an agency that sells the rights to them. I probably should call them and ask for an updated number, but We knew it surpassed 2,000 years ago. It's the first or second most performed play in American high schools most years.
Wow.
And rightly so, because it's a tremendous educational opportunity for students and faculty and the community and parents to give some thought to, you know, what are the actual results of hatred and how do communities deal with it? And if this happened in your community, how would you respond? Would you rise to the example of Laramie and have a heartfelt conversation about diversity in your community? Because this could happen anywhere today, and any community could be faced with those choices.
And being performed in red states as much as blue, which is, you know, encouraging.
Absolutely. It's been performed at some of the smallest rural schools that you didn't even know were out there. And we've talked to teachers in Iowa and Missouri and Nebraska and other places in the heartland who have maybe conservative school boards or superintendents about, you know, what is the case to be made for putting this on? And those educators usually have a positive result. They talk to, if need be, they talk to superintendents about, you know, here's what this play really is all about and what comes out of it. And we try to arm them with some information, but 9 times out of 10, at least, that play does get performed, and it's well attended, and it does have an impact.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Jason. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Jason Marsden, Executive Director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. You can find them at matthewshepard.org. That wraps up another fine edition of Clusterfucked. To listen to more episodes of this podcast, visit cfthepodcast.com. That's cfthepodcast.com. Now, we are available on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify and all the other places that you love to get your podcasts. But we do enjoy when you visit the website. As I mentioned, all the episodes are there, and there's a mailing list. The mailing list is what we really love. We can keep in touch with you that way, update you on episodes when they're released, and anything else we might be doing at CF headquarters. You just never know what's going on. So join the mailing list. It's free. You'll see the, I think, the bottom of the homepage there. You can just fill it in. It takes 30 seconds. And there's a support the podcast button as well. We love support. This is a labor of love. We do have expenses. We record at a very fine recording studio, dbaudio.ca. We have website updates and design and all that good stuff. So it costs a few bucks, and so we appreciate a few bucks if you feel so inclined. And we're on social media. Like us on Facebook. Follow us there. We do updates not just on the episodes, but in other things that relate to the fine topics that we discuss here at Clusterfucked Headquarters. And on Twitter, if Facebook and going to the website and wherever else you get your podcasts is not enough, you can also connect on Twitter. My handle there is at CF the Podcast. I'm actually called the Civil Liberal, but the actual Twitter handle, as I say, is at CF the Podcast. That wraps it up. Thank you for listening.
The Clusterfucked Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
I'm Roger King. That'll be all.